Well, tonight we continue our series on the existence of God. And as you know, we're toward the end of it with uses. In other words, how to apply them at the end to regular life, their benefit, utility in life. Of these doctrines we've pondered, these truths. I want to review just a little bit where we've come from. What ground we've covered. We've used Stephen Charnock's, the beginning of his two volumes on the existence and attributes of God, as the primary source. As you know, Stephen Charnock, the English Puritan, died in 1680. A way to look at what I've been doing in this series is kind of like what we've got on Friday night right now, is we're going through J.C. Ryle's book, Walking with God. But it's an abridgment of his book, Practical Religion. In a sense, I'm giving you an abridgment of Stephen Charnock's argument for the existence of God. It can be tough wading, heavy snow to plow through, reading through the English Puritans. So what I've tried to do is pluck out certain quotes that I think summarize things well and move the argument along and then add in some explanation along the way. And in a sense, it's a modern abridgment. You know, we're not recreating the wheel. There are certain main arguments for the existence of God, just as true in his day as our day. So his four main arguments, just for a quick review, his four main arguments for the existence of God. Number one was that the universal consent of all mankind manifests that there is a creator. That it is folly or foolishness to deny what all mankind universally has consented to, and that there is a higher being worthy of worship. That in all human tribes, across the history of humanity, all of them have been religious. And we know from the Bible it's in a warped form. Right? That's why there's idolatry all over the place. But that's like Romans chapter 1, verse 18, that they hold down, suppress, and warp the truth in unrighteousness. But they're all acknowledging in principle that there's a higher being deserving of worship. So that's the argument from universal consent. The second main argument, which was the biggest argument he had, had four parts to it. It's that all creatures manifest that there is a creator, that God exists. It is foolish or folly to deny what all creatures manifest. And he looked at four main things on that. In other words, all created things in their production, how they came to be, in their order and harmony, in their ends or purposes, and in their preservation. Production, order, harmony, ends, and preservation. All are evidence that God exists in every created thing. And we went through that in detail. It's the main body of his argument, that God exists. The third main argument, that God exists, he says you don't have to look out, you can just stare at the mirror. It's the argument from ourselves, that we ourselves as human beings manifest that there is a creator. It is foolish to deny what we ourselves manifest, in other words. And he looked at the human body, the human spirit, and mainly the mind is what he focused on, the human conscience, and human desire. Human desire for that all-satisfying good. And the only one who can be that one that satisfies our most greatest deep longing is God. So again, the argument from the human body, the human mind, the human conscience, and human desire. For every human desire, there's an object, and God has placed within us as human beings a desire for himself, to seek him and find satisfaction in him and him alone. He exists Just like your desire for toast is evidence that toast exists. Your desire to eat rice is evidence that rice exists. His fourth main argument for the existence of God was from extraordinary occurrences in the world. Extraordinary occurrences in the world. And there he was focusing on extraordinary judgments. When you've got a very wicked person and then some calamity befalls them, people recognize this, even among the pagan religions, right? Like karma. Yeah, people know this. That in the natural law, there's consequences. You violate the natural law, there's consequences. That's evidence that there's an ultimate lawgiver who's the judge of all. So extraordinary circumstances or occurrences in the world, first being extraordinary judgments, the second being miracles, supernatural events. So you think of a miracle is that which only God can do. It's supernatural, it's metaphysical, above nature. And then as well, in the extraordinary events, he focuses upon prophecy. Tonight, we're looking upon uses. And we just introduced it the last time that we met. And I just put a brief summary of what this first use is, that atheism is pernicious, meaning very harmful to the world and to himself, to the atheist himself. Charnock wrote this out, just to review again. This is the way he worded use one. You know, as the English Puritans, very thorough. He says, if atheism be foolish, then it is pernicious. Now the key verse, as the English Puritans do, we've seen that with Thomas Boston on the Sunday night studies, he has a key verse each time, right, going into a particular topic. Well, for Stephen Charnock, for this whole section on the argument for the existence of God, his key verse is Psalm 14:1, that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And the word for God is not Jehovah, for Yahweh, for the essence of God. No, the word that's used is Elohim. The fool says in his heart, there is no Elohim. Meaning, there's no sovereign over me, there's no judge in my life. That's the typical atheist. I'm not accountable to anybody. I do as I please and there's no final judgment. That's the atheist that's expressed in Psalm 14:1. That's why in every one of those main arguments, it's foolish or folly to deny what the universal consent of all mankind is. It's foolish or folly to deny what all creatures manifest. It's foolish or folly to deny what our own human nature manifests. It's foolish or folly to deny what the extraordinary circumstances of the world evidence. Why? It's all based on Psalm 14:1. He's a fool, rejecting what all these things evidence and manifest. So again, this is as an English Puritan, this is what he worded for use one. If atheism be foolish, then it is pernicious, very harmful, to the world and to the atheist himself. Wisdom, the opposite of foolishness, wisdom is the band of human societies, the glory of man. Folly, foolishness, is the disturber of families, cities, nations, the disgrace of human nature. It brings nothing but a troubled sea. Foolishness and folly and atheism in all its shapes and form destroys all social entities and the atheist himself. So, first, it is pernicious or very harmful to the world. And we had just introduced it by covering the first point under this, that it's pernicious to the world or very harmful to the world is atheism. And the first point is that atheism would root out the foundations of government. That atheism would root out the foundations of government. And I put Romans 13:5 there. If you'll turn in your Bibles to Romans 13:5. And that's that in the middle of this section on the Apostle Paul laying out God's prescription God's prescription saying what ought to be for civil governments in Romans 13, 1 through 10. But in Romans 13, 5, it says this, therefore, you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience's sake. But also for conscience's sake. And if you remember, we went through the evidence for the existence of God from human conscience. From human conscience. And you remember this quote I gave that Charnock said this. He said, all order in the world owes itself, next to the providence of God, to conscience. Without it, the world would be a Golgotha. Unquote. That's the key place of the human conscience. And we know from Romans 2:15 that the law of God is written on the human heart, and even the pagans who don't have the Bible show the work of the law in their lives. Because their conscience is either accusing them of wrong or defending them when they do right. We have a faculty in us called the conscience that God placed there, and He wrote the law in the human heart, Romans 2:15. And both John Calvin and Martin Luther, the great Protestant reformers, believed it was the Ten Commandments that God wrote on the human heart. What law? They believed it was the Ten Commandments, the ten general summary principles of God's moral law written in the human heart. And we have a conscience that accuses us when we do wrong and defends us when we do right. We know the human conscience is a human faculty. It can make mistakes. It only acts according to its highest standard of right and wrong that it knows. But all order in the world, next to the providence of God, owes itself to the human conscience. Atheism is denying the existence of God. The human conscience, as we covered, evidences that God exists as the lawgiver over us, and He both judges and rewards. He judges those who violate His law. The conscience accuses us of wrong, but also defends us. The conscience defends us when we do right, which is evidence that God's a rewarder of those who do right. So the conscience is evidence that there is a judge over me that I'm accountable to. Again, why would your human conscience, think of a situation where you feel guilty about something that only you know about. No other human being knows about it. If God didn't exist, why would you feel guilty? If no other human being knows about it, then the only thing you have to fear is what other human beings know. Feeling guilty about something that no other human being knows is evidence that God exists. Because He knows about it. And you know He knows about it. And you know that you're accountable to Him. Now think how that backs up then. That's what Paul is saying here in this section on the civil government in Romans 13, 1 through 10. Only God can bind the human conscience. Therefore, you must be subject to the civil government authorities, not only because of wrath, fearing their punishment for doing wrong, but also for conscience's sake. And the very root and foundations of civil government are destroyed if one says there is no God. As Charnock said, there is no tie upon the consciences of men without a sense of God's being. And let me just say real quick on number one. There's so much that could be said, but let me just say this. You and I know that the 20th century atheistic communism, scholars estimate, is responsible for murdering at least 100 million people. Atheistic communism. And the former USSR, former Soviet Union, was atheistic. How do atheistic regimes keep order in their society when they say there is no God? They keep order in society with a very heavy hand of threatenings and torments and a whole bunch of gulags that sends anybody that questions them to the gulag to be put in prison, tortured, so that everyone behaves. They're doing it in North Korea right now. Sheer violence and threats is the only way they keep order then. Point two under this topic is that atheism would introduce all evil into the world. Atheism would introduce all evil into the world. So I've got some quotes from Charnock, right? The abridged version, right? Charnock said this, quote, "If you take away God, you take away conscience, and thereby all measures and rules of good and evil," unquote. Read it again. "If you take away God, you take away conscience, and thereby all measures and rules of good and evil," unquote. When somebody who doesn't believe God exists starts talking about something being good and something being evil, you got to look at them and say, by what standard? As R.C. Sproul would say, who says? Who says? You? Well, my opinion's just as good as your opinion, so who says? Oh, because you can beat me up, so then it might makes right? You know, by what standard is something good and something evil? You have to judge it by a standard that's separate from what it is. You can't judge it by what it is in itself. That's the mistake many make who are atheistic and all they are is materialistic and saying this world is all there is. Well, then you have to use this world to try and judge this world. You can't. You need an outside objective standard from this world to be able to judge something good and evil. And as we know, in the Christian worldview, God is the author of all things, and therefore He has authority over all things. Any question of says, who says, is a question of authority. The right to command. The right to command. And again, our consciences are tied to what? In Romans 2:15. Tied to the law of God written in our heart. Commands. Right? Let's read Romans 2:15 again. We've read it before. Romans 2:15. I'll read verse 14 with it. "When the Gentiles who do not have the law," in other words, they don't have the Holy Scriptures, the Bible, where the laws of God are written out in detail, "by nature do the things in the law, that by and large they say, well, overall, you know, you shouldn't lie, you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't murder." They always warp it. They always twist it. You know, one warping is to say, well, you know, life doesn't begin until birth. So therefore, the baby in the mother's womb is not a baby. It's just the property of the mother. So we'll abort it. But everything else past birth is murder. Thou shalt not murder. They're doing the things in the law, but in a very warped form. In a warped form. "By nature, they do the things in the law. These, although not having the law," in other words, they don't have the Holy Scriptures, the Bible, "are a law to themselves." In what sense? This verse 15. "Who show the work of the law." They don't show the perfect carrying out of the law, but they show the work of it. It's work upon them, directing them in certain directions. That law is written in their hearts. Both John Calvin and Martin Luther believed it was the Ten Commandments. And their conscience, this human faculty that God placed in a human being, their conscience, which we believe then is in the heart or the spirit of man, also bearing witness between themselves, their thoughts, either accusing them or else excusing them. Excusing meaning defending them. It's either you're accusing them of wrong, you shouldn't have done that, or defending them. Hey, you did a good job. And the conscience is tied to a law, which means it's tied to a lawgiver, God. And we know that the law of God is holy and righteous and good. Romans 7:12. The law is holy and righteous and good. Why? Because God, the lawgiver, is holy and righteous and good. Now, I got to pause one sec here. Remember, those who've listened through Western Civ class, When modern psychology arose at the end of the 1800s, Sigmund Freud, who was an atheist, Carl Jung, who was into Gnostic occultist spiritualism. They're the two fathers of modern psychology. And they wanted to do away with guilt, which means they want to do away, in a sense, with human conscience. Guilt is a feeling, I deserve punishment. I've done wrong. And the conscience accuses us when we've done wrong. And their view is that, hey, that's just a man-made thing. You don't have to feel guilty. You're a victim of circumstances. Sigmund Freud, he was an atheist. This is a quote from Sigmund Freud. He said, God didn't create man. Man created God. That's Sigmund Freud. So then he's trying to say there's really no such thing as human conscience. Don't feel guilty about it. If there's any standards there, it's just man-made standards. Carl Jung, he's on another realm that says everything, in a spiritual sense, everything is one. He was into Hinduism as well as ancient occultism. And if all is one, then there's no distinctions. Everything's an illusion of distinctions. He himself was into all sorts of sexual perversion. So that was his way of doing away with evil and guilt, is all is one. Well, then there's no good either. There's nothing. All is one. Another way of looking at this, just to let you know too, with the atheistic evolutionary people. The atheistic evolutionary people, they know. If God exists, He's the author of all things. If He's the author of all things, He has authority over all things, which means He has the right to command. He places laws on us, and we're accountable to Him. And when we've disobeyed and violated His laws, we will be judged by Him. They know all of that. Their conscience is telling them that. You do away with the existence of God, and they know they can do whatever they please in life. There's no accountability, no judgment day. That's the real reason behind a lot of that atheistic evolutionary talk. A lot of evolutionary thinking goes along with this material world being eternal. It's just always evolving and changing. And that goes back to ancient Greek philosophy. It's a philosophy, not science. That's my point in that. It's a philosophy, not science. But this is where we need measures, we need rules, we need standards of good and evil. Again, you come across somebody that doesn't believe in the existence of God, and they're trying to argue about something being good and something being evil. You got to say, by what standard? They have no right to talk about good and evil, actually. Charnock said this, it's a quote, how could any laws be made when the measure and standard of them were removed? Unquote. How could any laws be made when the measure and standard of them were removed? Unquote. And this has been my big thing with America and Western civilization class, starting in Jerusalem. I think Western civilization, Christendom, started in Jerusalem, because then we have measures and standards by which, then, to make laws for our society. And remember, from Romans 13, 1 through 10, in verse 9, it only refers to the commands of the second table of the Ten Commandments, dealing with neighborly relations. That's what's obligatory and binding upon Gentile civil governments, to make laws regarding neighborly relations derived from the second table of the Ten Commandments. But the Ten Commandments are so general, as Dr. Dan Block said, one of Pastor Ron's professors from seminary in Old Testament, Dr. Dan Block said that the Ten Commandments are so general that they cannot be enforced in a court of law. So where do you go for details? With neighborly relations derived from the second table of the Ten Commandments, you go back to the Mosaic Law and the Pentateuch, where we find details. We find measures and standards by which to make laws for our society. There's many ways of looking at this, okay? I've said this before, I think in the American Western Civ class. I have a book. I used it in my master's degree thesis 25 years ago, by Heinrich Rahman, who was a lawyer during the time in Germany when the Nazi regime arose. And the book is about natural law. The book is about God's measures and standards that he put in nature, that he's written on the human heart. You do away with that, as the Nazis did, and everyone in that society was trusting just in the arrangement of their branches of government to keep freedom and law and order. But you take away the idea of the underlying measures and standards from God, you remove that, and you really have no basis to make your laws. This is really one of his main arguments, too. It's one of the great failures of Germany that allowed the rise of Hitler and Nazism. And then they start passing laws to exterminate the Jews and Poles and other ethnic groups. Anything goes at that point. I have a book on my shelf this thick just on social Darwinianism that the Nazis embraced in Germany in the 1930s. Pastor Ron? At rock bottom, they can never erase the fact that they're created in the image of God. Right. That's the view of Christian apologists. That this person you're talking to can never erase the fact that they're created in the image of God. They can't erase it with an eraser and get rid of it. They suppress it, they hold it down, they twist it and warp it willfully. But in the end, they know that those who do such things are worthy of judgment from God. Right? They know who, when judgment comes, they know who it's coming from. God's going to judge them, and they know it. They're trying to escape responsibility as well. They're trying to be as if they're their own little God. They want absolute freedom that only God has. They want to be able to do whatever they please at any moment, at any time. Only God does whatever he pleases, because he is God. And he is just, he is holy and perfect, so whatever he does is perfect and righteous. Romans 13:1, I put on the board there. Look at Romans 13:1. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no human authority except from God, and the human authorities that exist are appointed by God. If there is any human authority anywhere in family, church, state, business, any family, any business, any state, human authority anywhere, it's delegated by God. He is over it. And that entity is accountable to God with how they govern. Romans 13:3 and 4, for civil government rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. This is prescriptive. What ought to be? Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he, the civil government authority, is God's minister or servant to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister or servant, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Now you start counting up how many times good is there and evil is there. And then you say, by what standard? What measure? And that's where you go down to verse 9. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. Each in the second table, the Ten Commandments. And if there is any other commandment, are all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus' summary of the second table of the Ten Commandments. Matthew 22, verse 39. The second great commandment. Charnock has also said, with regard to the conscience, when we covered the conscience, but Charnock said this, quote, the worst of actions could not be evil if a man were a god to himself, a law to himself, unquote. Read it again. The worst of actions could not be evil if a man were a god to himself, a law to himself, unquote. I put on there, this is why the atheist wants to deny God's existence. Psalm 14:1. So he can do whatever he pleases. Be a law to himself, autonomous. Only God is autonomous. Only God is a law unto himself. We are not. We're creatures. Only the Creator is autonomous. To be a creature means we're subject to the Creator's laws. You can go and read atheistic philosophers, and that's what they're seeking. They're seeking absolute freedom, repeatedly. They're seeking absolute freedom. They don't want guilt. for anything. They want to be able to do anything without any consequences. They want absolute freedom. Charnock said this, quote, "The perverting the ways of men, oppression and extortion owe their rise to a forgetfulness of God." Unquote. I'll read it again. "The perverting the ways of men, oppression and extortion owe their rise to a forgetfulness of God." Unquote. Turn in your Bibles to Ezekiel 22, verse 12. Ezekiel 22, verse 12. In this section here on the sins of Jerusalem. Ezekiel 22, verse 12. "In you they take bribes to shed blood. You take usury, excessive interest on loans, and increase. You have made profit from your neighbors by extortion and have forgotten me, says the Lord God." And have forgotten me. And this is what Charnock is saying. "The perverting the ways of men, oppression and extortion owe their rise to a forgetfulness of God." In other words, their suppression of conscience is another way of saying it. Perverting the ways of men, oppression and extortion among men owe their rise when people try to suppress their conscience and not listen to it. Go back to Romans 1. Go back to Romans 1 and look at verse 28 about the depraved mind. "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge," forgetfulness of God, "God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting." Right? Now you get a whole litany, a whole list of sins. Perverting the ways of men, oppression and extortion. I mean, you go back to America's founding, and this is why you read the Declaration of Independence. It's so glorious. They were, by and large, Christian men wrote it. But they appealed in the opening paragraph to the laws of nature and nature's God. Laws of nature and nature's God. And said that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'll say this real quick on this topic. I remember back, you know, I'm an older man. I remember back watching Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings before the U.S. Senate. Biden was a U.S. Senator on the Judiciary Committee. And boy, did he ever go at Clarence Thomas, because Clarence Thomas believes in the natural law, the laws of nature and nature's God. Biden just went at him, "How dare you think such a thing? The perverting of the ways of men, oppression and extortion owe their rise to forgetfulness of God." How are you going to get a lot of corruption in government? A lot of wickedness out here in society with neighborly relations. Rampant crime. A court system you can't trust justice in. A forgetfulness of God. When they swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. They're like, well, God's man-made. If I follow Sigmund Freud, the atheist, I can say whatever I can get away with here. This way, nothing is secure. A man's reputation, his property, nothing is secure without a belief in God. Charnock says this, quote, "The whole earth would be filled with violence. All flesh would corrupt their way as it was before the flood." He used the word deluge. Time of Noah. "When probably atheism did abound more than idolatry. And if not a disowning the being, yet denying the providence of God by the posterity of Cain." Remember, Cain murdered Abel, and his descendants were wicked. "Those of the family of Seth only," quote, "calling upon the name of the Lord." The phrase that really caught me was when Charnock says here, "before the flood, when probably atheism did abound more than idolatry." And he takes it from Cain's line and descendants didn't call upon the name of the Lord at all. It just shows them at various earthly activities with tools and instruments and musical things and stuff, right? But Seth's line, the godly line, called upon the name of the Lord. And that's where he suggests, you know, hey, probably atheism did abound more than idolatry when violence filled the earth before the worldwide flood. I put two verses there. Look at Genesis 4:26. This is on Seth there. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh, when men began to call on the name of the Lord. And this is after the section on the descendants of Cain. And they were the ones who were craftsmen. It's in different verses, but as well, chapter 4, verse 22 in Genesis. An instructor there, a descendant of Cain, was instructor in every craftsman of bronze and iron. And then Lamech, there, a descendant, wicked descendant of Cain, verse 23. He is the first polygamist recorded in Scripture, having multiple wives. But go over to Genesis 6, 11 and 12, before the worldwide flood, right before it. The earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt. All flesh had corrupted their way on the earth, filled with violence. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. And you remember when we covered that in Psalm 14, 1 through 3. Just listen. Psalm 14, 1 through 3. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. They have all turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good. No, not one. So it is feasible that atheism, more than idolatry, was prevalent before the worldwide flood. Or what Charnock might say, practical atheism. Living as if there is no God. Not calling upon God. Charnock says this, quote, this is, he says, if there is no God, no respect is due to him. So all the religion in the world is trifle and error. Why give him worship, respect, reverence, if there is no God? See, so if there's no God, no respect is due to him. So then all religion in the world is trifle and error. And thus the pillars of all human society and that which has made commonwealths, civil societies, commonwealths to flourish, we still have on the books in Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, in our English history, okay? In America right now, it's called the Commonwealth of Virginia. But he says, all religion in the world and belief in God and his existence and the respect due to him, these are the pillars of all human society and that which has made commonwealths to flourish, but they'd all be blown away. So again, this is kind of summary points at the bottom, is all human authority is delegated by God. Romans 13:1. There is no human authority except from God, and the human authorities that exist have been established by God. Psalm 103, verse 19, God has established his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom, or his sovereignty, rules over all spheres of life. There's no exceptions. All human authorities are accountable to God. Romans 13:4, they're to be God's minister or servant in this world, doing his bidding, serving him. Whether in the family, business, church, state, whatever sphere. R.C. Sproul, once he said he got to speak when a governor was taking office in Florida. R.C. Sproul said he spoke as if it was the governor's ordination to be God's minister in the world. Which is what Romans 13:4 is talking about. Well, it's different than a pastoral minister, right, in the church. The civil government, the state, is different. What? They have to wield the physical sword, lethal force, deadly force, against evil, punishing criminals, to be God's servant in this world. So not only are all human authorities accountable to God, but all God's laws are the absolute objective standard of good and evil. Romans 13, 3 through 4 that we read in verse 9. The second table of the Ten Commandments with neighborly relations. And every human being has God's law written on his heart and a conscience to convict him of guilt when he disobeys and defend him when he obeys. Romans 2, 15, Romans 13, 5. So that was first. You have 2 points. So it's not only pernicious to the world, but it is pernicious or very harmful to the atheist himself. This is secondly. Charnock says, if he, that is the atheist, fear no future punishment, he can never expect any future reward. All his hopes must be confined to a swinish and despicable manner of life. Unquote. I like the way he refers to that. I'll read it again. If he, the atheist, fear no future punishment, he can never expect any future reward. All his hopes must be confined to a swinish and despicable manner of life. Unquote. Swines, in other words, for pigs, right? Some verses here. Look at Proverbs 17, 24. We've referred to this before, but just by way of reminder, Proverbs 17, 24, I'm thinking of the end of the verse there. But the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth. The fool, Psalm 14, 1, says in his heart, there is no God. There's no Elohim. There's no judge over me. I'm not accountable to anybody. Well, the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth. That's where his eyes are fixed. He's digging deep roots here. Philippians 3:19, another verse we've referred to before, but it's by way of reminder. Philippians 3:19, whose end is destruction, in other words, ultimate judgment from God, whose God, whose idol is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who set their mind on earthly things. Who set their mind on earthly things. Who have their eyes set on the ends of the earth only. Now, I included as well an example of swinish and despicable manner of life. The parable of the lost son, the prodigal. Let's read the beginning of that parable in Luke 15, 11 through 17. Then Jesus said, a certain man had 2 sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. So he divided to them his livelihood. Fool has his eyes set on the ends of the earth, as to whose God is their belly. Setting their minds on earthly things. What does he want? His earthly inheritance early. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there wasted his possessions with prodigal living. And when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in that land, and he began to be in want. Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger. In a swinish and despicable manner of life. This is where I think of the C.S. Lewis quote from him, where he talked about the little children being content in the mud puddles. Swine play around in mud puddles. Nasty, dirty mud puddles. Well, they'd rather do that when a whole holiday at the sea is offered to them. This is where we are as sinful human beings, right? This is what Charnock is saying. If he, the atheist, fear no future punishment. He can never expect any future reward after this world. This is it. And his hopes then are set only on earthly things, the mud puddles of this world that's sin-cursed. So all his hopes are confined to a swinish and despicable manner of life. All the cars get old and rusty. All the houses eventually have water leaks. And we can go on and on, chasing the wind. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity under the sun. That's right, amen. The utter foolishness of putting one's hopes on this world only. So in truth, these atheists, these people have no hope. They're without God, without Christ, having no hope. Ephesians 2:12. The idolaters and the atheists are all together in that. Ephesians 2:12, that at that time you Gentiles, you Greeks, were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world, living a swinish and despicable manner of life. Again, everything here that's earthly will not satisfy that desire that God put in us for God. We have a desire for an all-satisfying good, and only God can satisfy it. No earthly thing can. So atheism is harmful to the atheist himself. By confining himself only to this world, denying the existence of God is denying punishment, a judgment day, yeah, but that means there's no rewards either. It's harmful to him. All he's living is a swinish and despicable existence. And really, this is where you almost get to, a side note on that, is where you get to Albert Camus, one of the atheistic existentialists of the 20th century, the 1900s. Albert Camus, he said, basically the only question left is whether or not to commit suicide. A swinish and despicable manner of life. Charnock says this, the atheist, quote, disposes the noble end of his own being, which was to serve God and have a satisfaction in Him, to seek God and be rewarded by Him. And he that departs from his end recedes from his own nature. Unquote. Read that again. Charnock said, the atheist, quote, disposes the noble end of his own being, which was to serve God and have a satisfaction in Him, to seek God and be rewarded by Him. And he that departs from his end recedes from his own nature. Unquote. The chief end of man is to glorify God by enjoying Him forever. Right? Question 1 of the Westminster Shorter Catechism. Psalm 16:11, in God's presence is fullness of joy, and at His right hand are pleasures forever. We're created to glorify God, to serve Him every day, seek to please Him in all things. Colossians 3:17, whatever we do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, and have satisfaction in Him. To seek God and be rewarded by Him. To seek God and be rewarded by Him. 2 Chronicles 7:14, a familiar verse to many people. 2 Chronicles 7:14, the Lord to Solomon said, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land. Similar to the priestly blessing in Numbers 6:25, may the Lord make His face shine upon you and be gracious to you. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, seek my favor, seek to be pleasing in my sight, and turn from their wicked ways, repent, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land. Psalm 27:8, another familiar verse, Psalm of David, speaking to God, when you, God, said, seek my face, my heart said to you, your face, Lord, I will seek. You think of Matthew 6:33, the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus said, "But seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these other things shall be added to you, food and clothing, etc." And Hebrews 11:6, "Without faith it's impossible to please God, for he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him." These are the ends of human beings. This is our human nature. We're wired this way. And the only way we have happiness is running on the train tracks of God's laws. Just like a train on train tracks, as the great Swiss Reformed theologian Dr. Roger Nicole said. The Ten Commandments are God's train tracks, and He created us to run on those train tracks. And all we will get is derailed if we try and disobey and get off those train tracks. But this is us serving God, finding satisfaction in Him and joy, seeking to be rewarded. He's a rewarder of those who seek Him, right? But he, the atheist or the idolater that departs from this end, recedes from his own nature. Every creature finds happiness performing its end. Every creature finds happiness performing its end. Now, part of the argument for the existence of God is that every created thing manifests that there's a creator. In their production, their order and harmony, their ends, and their preservation. Now, every creature finds happiness performing its end, right? Think of Psalm 19:5, where the sun is mentioned at the end of verse 4. Right, we have the sun and moon and stars, right? The sun, verse 5, "which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices like a strong man to run its race." When we see the sunrise, right, from a human perspective, even though we know, right, it's a heliocentric universe. But describing it from a, just like the weatherman describes, you watch the weather at night, right? The sun rises, the sun sets, even though we know the earth is rotating, the sun is stationary. But describing it from a human perspective, the sun is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices like a strong man to run its race for the day. Every creature finds its happiness performing its end. Humans, in other words, you will not find happiness except acknowledging God's existence, believing that He is, and that He's a rewarder of those who seek Him. Hebrews 11:6. God exists, He's meant to be served, and we find satisfaction in Him. So we seek God and to be rewarded by Him. He exists, and we seek to be rewarded by Him through serving Him, by obeying Him, living for His glory every day. That's the only way we're going to find happiness in this world. And that's what the founders meant with the inalienable rights our Creator gave us of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the pursuit of happiness, that's what they meant in this world. They were Christian. So Charnock says there, he says, "as it is a joy to the sun to run its race," unquote. You look up and say, "ah, it's joyful today. Beautiful sunny day today." My wife Connie had talked to someone that was in Arizona last week, you know, frigid cold, and he says, "well, it's sunny." Joyful sun running its course. Charnock says this, I'll end with this tonight here, quote, "what content," we speak of contentment, satisfaction, "what content, what satisfaction can any man have that runs from his end, opposes his own nature, denies a God by whom and for whom he was created, whose image he bears, which is the glory of his nature, and sinks into the very dregs of brutishness, of a beast, of an animal, like a dog or a cat, or a pig, a swine." Read it again, then we'll look up Job. Charnock said, quote, what content, what satisfaction can any man have that runs from his end, opposes his own nature, denies a God by whom and for whom he was created, whose image he bears, which is the glory of his nature, and sinks into the very dregs of brutishness. Unquote. Into the very bottom and muck, beasts and animals. Because then what are you? If you're not created in the image of God, what are you? Just a highly evolved animal. That's it. But how can you have satisfaction and contentment? You're running from your end as the prodigal son. Opposing your own nature, denying a God by whom and for whom you were created, whose image you bear, which is the glory of your nature. And you're sinking into the very dregs of brutishness. So look up Job 18. I'll read here. Job 18:3, and then I put on the board there 7 through 21. This is Bildad, the words of Bildad, about the wicked being punished. Job 18:3, why are we counted as beasts and regarded as stupid in your sight? Let me read some of 7 and following. The steps of his strength are shortened of the wicked, and his own counsel casts him down, for he is cast into a net by his own feet, and he walks into a snare. The net takes him by the heel, and a snare lays hold of him, as an animal caught in a trap, right? A noose is hidden for him on the ground, and a trap for him in the road. Terrors frighten him on every side, and drive him to his feet. His strength is starved, and destruction is ready at his side. It devours patches of his skin. The firstborn of death devours his limbs. He is uprooted from the shelter of his tent, and they parade him before the king of terrors. They dwell in his tent who are none of his. Brimstone is scattered on his dwelling. His roots are dried out below, and his branch withers above. There's no fruit, right? The memory of him perishes from the earth. He's forgotten, and he has no name among the renowned. He is driven from light into darkness and chased out of the world. He has neither son nor posterity among his people, nor any remaining in his dwellings. Those in the west are astonished at his day, and those in the east are frightened. Surely such are the dwellings of the wicked. And this is the key. And this is the place of him who does not know God. And this is the place of him who does not know God. Who denies the existence of God, who is an atheist or an idolater, encompasses both. But Charnock is using it in the context with atheism. And sadly, we have people like this all around us. Yes, we do. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Pray that the Lord of the harvest would send workers into the harvest. Lord willing, we'll pick this up the next time we meet with use 2. Use 2, I've finished use 1.